Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldon. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear the first of a four-part series about critical thinking in Kentucky's colleges and universities. But first, another candidate has entered the Republican primary for Kentucky governor. The latest person seeking to challenge Governor Ernie Fletcher's re-election bid is former Congresswoman Ann Northup of Louisville. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh was on hand when Northup filed her candidacy papers in Frankfort last week and has this report.
Using Christmas money from her mom and $100 from running mate Jeffrey Hoover, Ann Northup paid the $500 filing fee with the Secretary of State's office and then walked upstairs to announce her candidacy from the second-floor mezzanine facing the Capitol Rotunda and the statue of Abraham Lincoln.
I am announcing my candidacy to become governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
Northup, who lost her re-election bid to Congress last November, said the decision to enter the governor's race just 2 months later was not an easy one.
I recognize that some Republicans may not prefer this primary campaign, but as a Republican and as a Kentuckian, I'm answering this call to service because our party and the people all across Kentucky deserve an alternative to the current governor.
And that wasn't the only pot shot she took at Governor Ernie Fletcher. In an obvious reference to the 15-month state hiring probe that led to Fletcher's indictment and eventual settlement but no outright apology, Northup said strong leaders, quote, have the ability and confidence to admit mistakes and take immediate corrective action.
The Democrats would love nothing more than to spend June through Election Day dragging our current governor's problems through all 120 counties. Our party needs a nominee who can and will be elected in November.
Then it was running mate Jeffrey Hoover's time to speak. The House Minority Leader said getting into the race was not an easy decision for him or his family, but he believes the people of the Commonwealth need an effective team of leaders, and he and Northup are the answer.
They need a team that will lead Kentucky not by fear, that will lead Kentucky not by intimidation, but will lead Kentucky by listening to the people.
Hoover and Northup took no questions, opting instead to hold a series of news conferences around the state in coming days. Governor Fletcher held his own news conference shortly after Northup and Hoover left the building and told reporters he's not worried about having primary opposition.
I think as a party matures, you're going to have primaries. I've had primaries in most of the races I've run. We've worked very strongly in a bipartisan way. And I think we as a state need to focus, too, extremely on bipartisanship. When I got here, there was a great deal of partisanship. I think that's improved substantially.
And Fletcher says he's running on his record, which he believes is strong.
We've changed the culture. We've increased the number of jobs. We've improved health care, I believe, and we'll continue to work on that. That's a good foundation.
And Fletcher says he's in the race to stay.
Tony, I've said from the very beginning, we're here, we've got an outstanding record, and we're running. I think you'll find that we've got a tremendous amount of support. If you look, we're at least $1.2 million in fundraising above what we were when I ran in 2003.
He'll need the money because the third candidate in the Republican primary race is Paducah businessman Billy Harper, who has already spent more than $2 million of his own money on television ads introducing himself to voters. Harper released a statement in the wake of Northup's announcement saying the former congresswoman's entrance into the governor's race, quote, highlights the need for change in politics as usual. Northup spent 10 years in Congress and 9 years in the Kentucky House. Will anyone else enter the Republican primary? That remains to be seen. But the filing deadline of January 30th is fast approaching. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
While it might be possible to learn all you need to learn in kindergarten, some worry that's no longer possible in college. They say technologies are advancing too quickly and the economy changing too rapidly. Today's young Kentuckians face a highly uncertain future, and it has their teachers wondering how they can best prepare their students for that future. Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton reports.
When they justify more funding for higher education, government officials, business leaders, and even college administrators rarely talk anymore about education's importance to the republic or its contribution to the culture. Usually they talk about students in economic terms, as if they're a commodity needed by Kentucky as it prepares for a high-tech worldwide economy.
To really look at revamping it to make it more international, more global, to look at how we should change our undergraduate curriculum to really be more competitive in the world as it is today.
They're going to be looking at every individual in their community, and they're going to figure out how do we educate that person, how do we bring that person along, and how do we make sure they're a contributing member of our workforce.
There still is a positive return on investment for education, so it does make sense to increase your human capital, is what we would call it.
We create a $630 million increase in human capital every single year.
Human capital is the key to the long-term economic future of our state. And so while the price has been going up, there's no question that the return on that investment is well worth it.
And it's not just officialdom that demands more vocational education from Kentucky's colleges and universities. Students and their parents also seem mainly interested in the payoff. Dr. Jalal Razai chairs the Department of Computer Sciences at Eastern Kentucky University.
I receive numerous phone calls. The students ask if we offer such and such course. That's all they want to do, take that course. They talk about certifications. Why do I have to go through 4 years where I can get such and such certification and get a six-figure job?
The demand on education for more vocational training can be seen by a simple examination of a university's organizational chart. For example, at EKU, there's a Center for Economic Development, Entrepreneurship, and Technology, an Office of Teacher Admissions and Certification, and a Department of Medical Services Technology. But now, some educators think higher education has put too much emphasis on vocational training.
Well, they have.
EKU professor Anda Bennett.
What's happened in the last 20 years is that in education, we've focused on teaching skills, which is an appropriate goal, but if we teach only skills, then when students leave the university, they can't think.
Bennett is leading a group of administrators, faculty, and students who hope to retool EKU. Too often, they say, today's college graduates are like cogs in a giant machine. They work fine as long as that machine remains unchanged. But when the machine is upgraded or replaced, those graduates can find themselves obsolete. Dr. Jalal Razai sees it all the time.
Getting that certificate or just passing that course might open a door for you for one job. But if that company decides to change the software they're using, or they're no longer in need of a person with that certificate, what is going to happen to you?
What's needed, says Razai and Bennett, are graduates who know how to evolve as the economic machine evolves. So there's always a demand for their services.
We have to teach students more than just the facts of a thing. We have to teach them how to think about it and then how to ask good questions, how to look at data, explore information, make some reasoned judgments, and come up with some conclusions that may be different than what they learned in college.
The average Kentuckian might call that common sense. But in education circles, such skills are referred to as critical and creative thinking. And more colleges say those lessons can and should be taught in every course that a student takes. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
A pair of pygmy hippos at the Louisville Zoo are proud parents of their second offspring. The female was born last month, but because of the holiday season, zoo officials announced the birth this week. Only 50 pygmy hippos exist in captivity in North America. The Louisville Zoo now has 4. Louisville Zoo General Curator Steve Wing spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the new baby pygmy hippo.
Tell me a little bit about baby pygmy hippos, first of all. Give me a little background on what they are.
Well, a pygmy hippo is a close relative of the common Nile hippo that everybody sees on the Animal Planet and nature shows, but nobody knows very much about pygmy hippos. They're believed to, hippos in general, actually used to be thought of as distant relatives with pigs and peccaries and those types of animals, but recent information has them being more closely related to whales, which is, once you really think about it, is kind of an interesting classification for them. But pygmy hippos are quite a bit smaller than their relatives. You know, adult regular hippos, you know, can get to be about 3 tons or 6,000 pounds. Pygmy hippos are about 400 to 600 pounds, but they almost look like miniature Nile hippos, which, of course, they aren't.
Why are they most closely related to whales?
Well, I haven't had a chance yet to dig into that information that came out, but they have done DNA work and traced their lineage back and found that their closest ancestor was actually also an ancestor for whales. So they share a lot of the same characteristics, but obviously they were very divergent, and you know, with whales not being able to come up on land at all. And hippos are actually fairly graceful when they get out and into, you know, out onto land, and so they nothing like each other now. Nobody would have guessed it, I think.
Now, the birth of this pygmy hippo in captivity is pretty rare. Tell us about that.
Yes, it is, and it's not because they're difficult to take care of. It's just that they have never been very common in captivity. Period. Before about 1970 or so, they were very, very rarely exhibited. And they do have kind of special needs, you know, with the pool and everything. So it's you know, as technology has gotten better over the years, it's been much easier to exhibit them, so more institutions have them. But there still is only about 50 of them in AZA-accredited zoos in North America. And right now we've got four of those, and we're pretty excited about having the baby here.
That's amazing. And this is the second baby for these mates?
Yes, it is. This exhibit opened in, they're in the Gorilla Forest, which opened in, I believe, 2002. And that's when we got this species here, and they have settled in very well, obviously. And we don't have a name yet for the little baby, but her older sister, her older sister's name is Kabibi, and they are both doing very well.
You had a contest before to name, was it a giraffe?
Well, we had a naming contest for Kabibi, the older pygmy hippo. I think in the past we have had naming contests for giraffe, though, too, yes.
Will you have a naming contest for this one?
You know, we haven't decided that yet. I think everything's been just so busy around here lately with the hippo birth and, you know, getting ready for the spring season and, you know, the cold weather suddenly coming in that we really haven't had much of a chance to think about that yet.
And speaking of the cold, you've got the baby and the mother off exhibit. Tell us a little bit about that and why that's happening right now.
Well, the exhibit that was designed is an outdoor exhibit, and we have pygmy hippos are very tropical, and they don't like cold weather too much at all. You know, usually down to around 50 degrees or so we can keep them outside. And their outdoor and their indoor pool, for that matter of fact, are heated, and we try to keep that above 80 degrees. And when it gets this cold, when it starts getting cold outside, we have difficulty keeping that outdoor pool that warm. So they're going to be put on an exhibit. I mean, if we get a nice warm spell or something like that in the middle of February, they will definitely go out. So that's why we can't really tell when they will be out yet.
Hopefully when the cold breaks, we'll be able to go and see the baby hippo. The hippo was born in December. Why did the zoo wait this long to tell us about it?
Well, I think for one of the reasons, we wanted to make sure mom and baby were doing well. We kind of do that with all of our births, and you know, we knew right off that Tracy, the mother, was going to be a wonderful mom. She did such a good job with Kabibi, and then I think just with the holidays and everybody being off and you know, taking vacation and stuff like that, we've just been a little light around here with staff, and just are now sitting down and trying to, you know, that we're all back and can figure these things out.
I understand you have Kabibi and the father, and then you have Tracy and the new pygmy hippo together. They're together, Tracy and the new pygmy hippo and Kabibi and the father. Why is the whole family kind of split there? Is there a reason?
There is a reason, and not a lot is known about pygmy hippos in the wild. They come from the tropical rainforests and jungles of Western Africa, and it's very difficult for people to get into their native habitats, you know, all the dense jungles, and basically the only way you can navigate through those areas is along the rivers. So not a lot is known about them, but it is believed that they are fairly solitary in the wild and do not normally form family groups, although their ranges might overlap. So what we did when Kabibi was born the first time is after she was a little bit older, it took about 6 to 8 weeks, we did put Maji, the father, back in, and they've done fine ever since. So we'll probably do about the same with this new baby and just make sure that she's strong enough and is large enough to, get away or whatever she wants to do when we put the others in with her.
Do you think Tracy and Maji will have more offspring?
Well, you know, we're sure hoping it, and we're kind of hoping for a little boy next time. But, as long as they're healthy, we're happy with that.
Will we keep all four pygmy hippos here at the Louisville Zoo?
No. Pygmy hippos are managed within the AZA, the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, has a program called the Species Survival Plan. And what that is all the pygmy hippo experts around the country and, even internationally will get together and they will make breeding recommendations and decide where animals need to be moved to. So our first baby, Kabibi, may be sent to another zoo, maybe if Indianapolis had an exhibit or the Houston Zoo, and she may go there for a breeding program.
The new hippo, how big was it when it was born, and how big will it get?
Well, she was, I think, around 9 pounds. I think Kabibi was 12 pounds. And when she is an adult, she's probably going to be, I would say, between 400 and 500 pounds.
Is that similar to her parents?
Yes. We haven't weighed her parents in a while. We're actually in the process of getting a scale moved into there so we can get a good weight on them. But we think that Tracy, the mother, probably weighs about 450 to 500 pounds.
And I understand you have some pictures of the baby on the zoo website.
I do believe that some have been posted up there and that we're going to continually post those pictures up there so people can see her develop even when they can't see her on exhibit.
That's great. And the website is louisvillezoo.org. Steve, is there anything I've forgotten to ask you?
Well, I think we've covered it pretty well. Like I said, we're very excited that, for Maji's and Tracy's newest edition, and we just can't wait for her to get out on exhibit and people come and learn about the pygmy hippos and develop a nice bond with them and interest in them and kind of spirit people on to do some more conservation work with them.
How can they get involved in conservation work with a zoo?
I tell you, there are a lot of different ways. And I think the easiest way would be to contact the zoo directly and, go onto the website, become a zoo member, come to the zoo and learn as much as they can first. And then, we're always using volunteers and donations and all sorts of, fun things to do and help us support the programs that we support around the world.
Okay, Steve Wing, General Curator of the Louisville Zoo. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That was Louisville Zoo General Curator Steve Wing discussing the new baby pygmy hippopotamus with WFPL's Heidi Caravan. When we come back, we'll learn more about College Goal Sunday, an event that helps low-income college students find money for higher education. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Hellett. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Heidi Caravan speaks with Louisville Free Public Library Director Craig Buteau about The Big Read. But first, College Goal Sunday is a statewide program that provides free information and assistance to families applying for college financial aid. It will take place Sunday, January 28th in Louisville and 18 other Kentucky communities. WFPL Stan Cook talked with Kim Dolan, the Jefferson County Outreach Counselor for the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority, about the event.
Tell us a little bit about what that's about and in general, a little bit of history of what that's about.
Okay. College Goal Sunday is an event that is for students who are going to be entering college next school year and their families to come and receive information about financial aid resources that are going to be available to them, and also to receive help with filling out the financial aid forms. There is a federal financial aid form that most colleges and universities require students to fill out. It's called the FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, and a lot of people need help with that if they've never filled it out before. So this event gives them that help. Financial aid professionals are there to help them out with that. And the event actually started, it's been around for quite a while, started back in 1989 in Indiana. It's now spread across the country, and Kentucky has been doing it for many years now. And our event is going to actually be, like you said, in a week from Sunday, January 28th at 2 o'clock p.m.
According to the Kentucky Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, participation in state aid programs more than quadrupled since the 1990s?
It sure has. Well, you know, if we think, we hear in the news all the time, you know, schools are raising tuition and, you know, they, you know, state and private schools alike. So I think now, you know, more than ever, students need some sort of assistance to help them cover their college expenses. Maybe families don't save like they used to and things like that. So certainly we've seen participation, like you said, quadruple since 1990. In the 2005-2006 academic year, Kentucky State financial aid programs helped over around 120,000 students. So we do see a lot of students taking advantage.
And I would suspect that a lot of the folks who apply and who will be showing up to get this underway are in a situation that if they didn't have it, a lot of them wouldn't be going to colleges or in any universities.
Absolutely. And that's what the event is really geared towards, those families who are going to need financial aid, that if they didn't have it, they otherwise might not be able to reach their educational goals. This is an event that's really geared towards them. Of course, it's open to anyone, but especially those families that really have to have the aid in order to get an education beyond high school.
As we've all heard, especially concerning the University of Louisville, the cost for going to U of L going up, not only tuition, but other aspects of it, just room and board, that type of thing, books, and other universities as well. The cost is not been holding steady. It continues to go up, and that is really from a lot of studies that have been out recently showing a strain being put on families coming up with that money to send their kids to school.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you said, even, you know, students who live here in Louisville, maybe they want to live on campus, so the room and board, books and supplies, you know, things that some families, you know, have not been used to paying for up to this point. You know, they're going to start having, you know, quite a large expense with a college education. And we certainly, you know, we're out here to do this event because we think that higher education is not only important but critical nowadays. So we want these students to move on to education beyond high school, but they need resources to help them do that. So,
and I think that's an important point that you're making is, you know, I can remember back in the good old days when I went to college. So long ago, it was a desirable thing to do, but it wasn't necessary.
Right.
And I think that's kind of switched now, where it's become a necessity. If you're going to really, you know, make your way in this world in a significant way, this is something that you're going to have to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, really, like you said, you know, there are lots of kids, I think, are first-generation college students because maybe when their parents were getting out of high school, they could find, you know, a good job, benefits, things like that. And now, just to get the foot in the door, students are having to at least have some college, preferably a bachelor's degree. You know, some careers that they're interested in require education beyond even a bachelor's degree. So it is a necessity. And getting the degree isn't only a necessity for the career that they may be interested in, but we show with studies that we've done in the state and also national studies that the earning potential that students have in order just to have the lifestyle that maybe they've been accustomed to living with mom and dad, in order to continue that, they're going to need an education. Because I think right now the most recent numbers we have show that on average, graduates with a bachelor's degree earn about twice as much per year as students who don't have any college. And that's kind of, you know, over a period of time, but still, it makes a big difference having that education.
Oh, without question. Going through the process, and I can imagine it would be absolutely, for some of these kids, just confounding and confusing. Going through that process of finding out, well, how am I going to afford going to college? And when you get into that process of, you know, seeking federal aid or some kind of student assistance in some areas, that must be a maze for them. So, and I assume that's a big part of what this event is all about.
Yes, College Goal Sunday does really serve to provide not only assistance with that financial aid application, but information in general, answers to questions. Certainly, like you said, the financial aid process can be, or seem at least, to some folks, especially students who are first generation, kind of a daunting task. They've never had maybe a family member or a parent who's gone through this, and they're tackling it for the first time, and there's all sorts of information out there about it. So certainly, College Goal Sunday is out there to provide a way for them to, you know, come to a free event. You know, they don't have to pay anything to come to this, and they can get information. There's a session at the beginning starting at 2 o'clock where they can just get general information about financial aid, learn what's out there for them and how this whole process works. And then after that, sit down one-on-one with financial aid administrators that have volunteered from the colleges around the community in order to sit down with them and help them with that paperwork.
You know, that's something I wanted to find out about, to give them a sense of what they could expect when they arrive. They're going to get that general presentation to begin with, but then, you know, they can actually go through the process with some folks. So kind of give us an idea of what it's going to be like when they show up.
Okay. Like we said, the event, Sunday, January 28th, does begin promptly at 2 o'clock. So we do ask that students and their families arrive on time. They're going to have kind of a choice, really. If they want to sit through the informational session, that is up to them, but that will start at 2, and they can get just general information. We recommend that because a lot of families, you know, like we said, haven't been through this process before and may need just some background information about how this whole thing works. If they already know some things or have gotten information from their school counselor or what have you, then they can choose to come in and just get the assistance with their financial aid forms. And there are a couple of ways they can do that. We recommend that students plan on attending with a parent or guardian. Both the student and the parent need to plan on bringing their 2006 income tax information. Ideally, if they've had a chance to prepare their return, that's great. I know, you know, end of January, some people may not have even gotten their W-2s yet. So whatever income statements, a paycheck stub or what have you, that they can bring would be great. And then they can start from scratch and get this form filled out with assistance from a financial aid professional. Or if they've already started it at home, maybe they've taken the initiative, then they can come in just with the forms that they've completed, ask questions. Maybe they think that they've got it right, but they're not quite sure and they just want some reassurance before they actually submit the form.
And this can speed the process up for them quite a bit if they can be prepared in that way and come to do business, so to speak.
It does. If they come prepared, come with the forms that we recommend. Again, the 2006 tax information, W-2s are great. A completed tax return is ideal if that's possible. Any income or other benefit statements they may have from 2006 would be great as well, because all the FAFSA, which stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid, that form does require the student and their parents to put financial information on there. That's how the government determines what they're going to be eligible for in financial aid.
And who will they be talking to when they get into these one-on-one sessions? Who are the kind of folks that are going to be available to them?
Most of the volunteers come from colleges and universities around the community where the locations are. So they're going to be talking to the same people that if they went to their school and walked into the financial aid office, these would be the same people they would be talking to there. The great thing is that they can come and all in one location. There are financial aid professionals that have come from all sorts of different schools, so they don't necessarily have to make the trip to their college campus. They can come to this and kind of get everything taken care of in one day. But they will certainly can rest assured that they're going to get professional, credible advice whenever they're getting help with this form.
And once they go through that process on that particular day, what happens with them after that? Is there a way for them to follow up, you know, with some of the folks they talk to afterwards if something comes along later that they don't understand or have a question?
Sure. And when they're filling out this financial aid form, they are going to be listing the schools, colleges, universities, community colleges, what have you, that they're going to be applying to. And they can list up to six schools. So what happens that day is we're going to help them fill out the form so that they can get it submitted. After that, certainly that they can follow up with the colleges and universities that they listed on their form, because the information will then be sent out to those schools. And they can follow up. The schools will have the information, and then they can start that conversation with their schools about, okay, now I've turned in the forms. Tell me what I'm eligible to receive.
That can give them a real good basis to go from. So if they can have, you know, six opportunities there, list six different schools, then they could kind of do a comparison in a sense as to what's going to work best for them.
You're exactly right. And we do recommend that students use financial aid award letters, which they'll get after they've submitted this form, from their schools to maybe compare, you know, see what schools are offering them in the way of educational grants, scholarship money, student loans, even work-study programs, see what opportunities they have. And yes, they can use that to maybe make their final choice, especially if they're kind of on the fence, don't know where they want to go. This could be the way to make that final decision.
Now, College Goals Sunday is going to be Sunday the 28th of January, but not just in Louisville. It's going to be here in Louisville, a couple of sites.
Right.
Do you have those?
Yeah, I do have those. Again, the Kentucky event is Sunday, January 28th at 2 o'clock p.m. It's statewide. There are actually 20 locations across the state of Kentucky in 19 different communities. Here in Louisville, we have two locations. We have one at Male High School in the cafeteria. It's out on Preston Highway. And we have another location at Jefferson Community and Technical College on East Broadway in the VTI building. So two locations here in Louisville. Even folks who live out maybe in the eastern part of the county, there's a location in Crestwood in Oldham County at the South Oldham High School. So maybe if they're a little closer to that side of the county, they may just want to go into Oldham County, and they're certainly welcome to do that. I also want to mention, while we're talking about the Kentucky locations, that this year is the first year that we are going to be offering a $500 scholarship at each of the locations. So students who do choose to come to this event and get help with their financial aid forms will be entered. When they walk in the door, they can register, and we'll be doing a drawing at each location for a $500 scholarship.
Wow, so just more incentive to show up.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the process you go through where you have to do your taxes and things like that. It's not anything we, you know, really look forward to doing. But, boy, if you can really find your way to this event and go ahead and go through the process, it can really make a big difference and get it out of the way and get you some answers really quick. And then on top of it, you have a chance for a $500 scholarship.
You're exactly right. And I think a lot of people, too, once they get in there and they get the help, you know, they gain a little bit of confidence and they see that it's not as bad as they think it's going to be. And, you know, that's why the help is there, to make it even easier and go ahead and get this in. And then they have one more step completed on their way to getting their education and getting into school.
You did mention that it's going to, or did you mention that this is going to be held in Indiana as well?
There is. You know, like we said, the event has kind of moved across the country, and Indiana is going to have their College Goals Sunday a couple of Sundays after the Kentucky event. It's actually in Indiana going to be on February 11th, again beginning at 2 o'clock p.m. that Sunday. And over in New Albany is where the closest location to Indiana would be. And that location is going to be at Indiana University Southeast in the Ogle Cultural Center. So again, February 11th for the Indiana date.
Okay. Education is, you know, anyone who's paying attention to politics will tell you that it is a significant issue, and especially in Kentucky, it is something that we have struggled with to bring everybody, so to speak, up to standards. And for a lot of these people, you know, to really make that leap to bring the state up, you know, you got to have that higher education. This helps get some people in that normally would have a lot of difficulty even making their way there.
You really, yes, higher education, like we were saying, is really a necessity, and for the better of our community. You're certainly right. When corporations and different businesses are looking to relocate to Louisville, one thing they look at is the educational attainment of our population. So things like that, the more of us that have not only some college and associate's degree, but hopefully even moving on to get that four-year bachelor's degree, can really make a difference for the better, you know, to better our community. So,
and it is a really, I tell you, the competitive nature of the marketplace anymore is just astounding. And if you're not in that ball game, so to speak, and you don't have that degree or some experience in that way, you're going to be in a difficult spot for an individual, but for a community and for the country, it all ties together economically and everything. The more we can bring everybody up, educationally, the better the whole state's going to be.
It does, yes. And in Kentucky is a state, you know, hearing some recent statistics that I had a chance to look at, Kentucky is a state that we do a good job of getting some college, getting maybe even an associate's degree, but really we need to be making that push towards the four-year bachelor's degree, because that's, again, what's going to, you know, be attractive to corporations that may want to come into our community, or keeping corporations here that already are. So, you know, when students are looking at educational opportunities after high school, they really need to be considering, you know, for the long term, for a four-year education or even more than that, not only, you know, for themselves, but for making sure that the jobs are here that they can get with that education. So.
Indeed. For those who, I can't imagine anybody, you know, not needing some help financially going to college anymore. I suppose there are some folks who don't need the help, but the vast majority of kids do, to some degree or another. And this is an extraordinary opportunity for them to find out what's there and to tap into that and further themselves and the community as well. It's going to be 19 different locations throughout the state of Kentucky. Two locations here we've already discussed in Louisville, one in Crestwood. And it's Sunday the 28th.
Yes, okay. 2 o'clock p.m.
Across 2 o'clock local time, wherever you
wherever, yes, wherever your community is, 2 o'clock local time, yes.
And, of course, we've you already mentioned the Southern Indiana situation as well. An annual event?
It is an annual event, typically the end of January here in Kentucky anyway. So juniors who and their parents, probably not a good idea to come this year because you still have another year of high school, but certainly keep it in mind for next year. It does happen every January.
Okay, who's behind all of this? Who makes all this happen?
The College Goals Sunday event here in Kentucky is organized by the Kentucky Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, or CASFA for short. And the event is sponsored financially by really three major sponsors, the Lumina Foundation for Education, the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority, and the Student Loan People. But, of course, in addition to those three major sponsors, there are countless individuals. Like I said, everyone who's at the event is a volunteer, so a lot of people make this possible by volunteering their time before, during, and even after the event.
Kim Dolan, Jefferson County Outreach Counselor, thank you for being with us. We appreciate that. We hope you have a fantastic College Goals Sunday on the
28th. Thank you very much for having me.
More information about College Goals Sunday can be found at our website. Go to WFPL.org and select Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Heidi Caravan talks about Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, with Library Director Craig Buteau. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. The Louisville Free Public Library is one of 42 around the country participating in The Big Read. The idea is for residents to read the same book during the same period and discuss that publication. In Louisville, the Big Read has selected Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Louisville Free Public Library Director Craig Buteau talked with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the Big Read and its impact on the region.
The Big Read's a program of the National Endowment for the Arts in cooperation with the Institute for Museum and Library Services, which is the federal agency that supports museums and libraries. The Big Read is an effort to get Americans reading and talking about books together. The idea is that you reach a deeper understanding of a book when you talk to your neighbor who has also read the book. It's a worthy program. It comes out of an original program in Seattle a few years ago, about 10 years ago, where all of Seattle read the same book.
Now, how was the Louisville Free Public Library chosen to be one of 42 public libraries in the country to take part in the Big Read?
We received a $20,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, and we've also been supported by the Community Foundation of Louisville and the Kellogg Foundation. The library will be the centerpiece, but there are other community agencies and people in town who will be involved. We were selected in part because of our past experience holding major cultural programs across the community, and because, well, frankly, we wrote a pretty good grant application.
That always helps. This might sound like a gushing question, and I don't mean it to be, but why is the library so popular in Louisville? It's obviously more popular in Louisville than it is in other cities of the same size. Do you have any idea?
We have a lot of ideas. The library in Louisville really is popular. There's a high degree of community support for the library. It comes through in the high number of people who use the library and visit across our threshold to check out books. But it's also clear to us when we do any fundraising that there are people in the community willing to contribute money to help make the library a success. I think the library is known in Louisville as a community-based educational institution, and people love it.
Back to the Big Read, we had eight major American works of literature to choose from, and you chose Their Eyes Were Watching God. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, we chose that book because we wanted to work with the Jefferson County Public Schools and find a novel that 10th graders would read as part of their American literature curriculum. We wanted to be able to reach out to as many 10th graders as we possibly can, and as it stands now, it looks like we're going to be distributing about 5,000 copies of this book. The book itself is a period piece set during the Harlem Renaissance. The book itself is a very personal perspective on life in early 20th century the U.S. For an African-American woman and American. The book itself is thought of as a terrific snapshot of the period, but also a moving, understanding position about what it was like to be a woman at the time.
And the grant money will go toward helping spread this book around.
Yes, the biggest portion of the grant funds will go toward purchasing copies of the book. We'll distribute 5,000 copies through schools in the area, and we'll also have 900 copies of the book at the library for people to check out. Anybody who wants to check out a copy of the book can just come to the library and we'll get you one. Or if you have a book club or a book group that you read together, where you read together, we'll provide a copy for each of the members of your book club. We do something we call book discussion kits, where we bag up a dozen copies of the book along with a reader's guide and some notes about the author and make the whole kit available for checkout, so one member of the reading club can supply copies for everybody in the group.
How many people do you think will take part?
Well, I think we're going to end up with thousands and thousands of people reading this book, starting with the 10th graders at Jefferson County Public Schools and extending to other schools. The University of Louisville is going to have students reading this book, and then going on into the community people at large, book clubs, book discussion groups that happen in libraries, and individuals who want to read this book. I think the month of February, you're going to see people with this book under their arm walking to work or catching the bus or sitting in the lunchroom. People will be reading this book.
Tell us a little bit about the book discussion programs you've already scheduled.
We have about 100 programs scheduled, and they are everywhere from branch libraries. All of our branch libraries will be doing this, right down to people's living rooms. There'll be some businesses that hold book discussion groups for their employees and borrow copies of the book from the library. There'll be lots of folks in the individual libraries, and some of our librarians will be out in their communities having book discussion groups off-site. We'll also have a lot of churches taking part in this. And as I said, the Jefferson County Public Schools is going to have discussions in 10th grade classes all across the county.
Why 10th grade? Why was 10th grade chosen?
10th grade was chosen because this fits into the American literature curriculum for 10th graders. That's the year when they study this book or books like it. And so we wanted to tie in with what they were doing.
We neglected to talk about the author as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the author of Their Eyes Were Watching God?
Yes. She was Zora Neale Hurston. She was born in 1891 and lived till 1960. From Florida, she was thought of as an intellectual and is a spiritual foremother to a generation of black and women writers. That's the way the National Endowment for the Arts describes her. She was born in Alabama, but moved to Florida. She was an intellectual when it was not an easy thing to be an African-American female intellectual.
Do you think this book will change people, will change the way people think?
I think people getting together and talking to each other always changes us. We learn something about what's inside the mind of another person. We start there in this discussion. We start there with the author. We learn what was in the mind of the author and how she projects into the mind of the character. And then as we sit down with other people who have also read the book, we'll learn what's in their minds. That is a step toward understanding each other better.
Tell us about the kickoff at the main library.
The kickoff event will be on February 1st at 7 p.m. Lorna Littleway will be doing a one-woman show of Zora Neale Hurston. It's called The Last Dust Track. She's performed the program at the Zora Neale Hurston Museum in Florida. The event is free. It's at the library on February 1st at 7 p.m. It's free, but you have to have a ticket to get in, so call us for free tickets. The number to call is 574-1644.
I've been speaking with Craig Butoad, the director of the Louisville Free Public Library, about the Big Read. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thank you very much.
More information about the Big Read, Zora Neale Hurston, and the Louisville Free Public Library can be found at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. Studio 619 and the staff of WFPL want to take a moment to wish one of our own a very happy birthday. Although she's a little hesitant to admit it, Julie Goodwin turns 28 today. Happy birthday, Julie, and best wishes for many more to come. That does it for this week's show. For more information about Studio 619, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.